This is the 2017 Pacific Northwest Daughters of Sarah Weekend. Brother Roger Lewis is leading our studies on the topic, Hannah, Handmaid of the Highest. This class, class number 5, is entitled, Hannah and Her Child. The reading was 1 Samuel 2, verse 11 to 19.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman. And as our Chairman has announced, our next session then carries on immediately after Hannah's song, of course, and the record takes up, therefore, from verse 11 onwards, as it says, Elkanah went to Ramah to his house. The song has finished, her vow has been made. She has offered thanksgiving on the day that she should have, and now they're going to return home. But, of course, the little child is going to remain in Shiloh. You see what it says in verse 11? It says, Elkanah went to Ramah to his house. Now we know that Hannah must have returned at the same time. Obviously they came up together and they're going to go home together. She's just concluded her song. In fact, the record says that on more than one occasion. Do you see back in chapter 1, verse 19, they rose up early in the morning and worshipped before Yahweh and returned and came to their house. And likewise, at the end of verse 20 in chapter 2, it's going to say, and they went to their own home. But this time, for some reason, and 1 Samuel chapter 2 verse 11, it only says that Elkanah went to his house when quite clearly Hannah would have been with him. So why does the narrative on this occasion focus only on Elkanah returning home and not Hannah? And I think the reason is because the emphasis here is on the fact that Samuel is not just weaned from his mother, chapter 1 verse 24, but will now be separated from his father and his father's house. The little boy, from this moment, is going to live in another house and he's going to serve another father, according to a higher principle than that of flesh and blood. So what we're being told is that truly he was separated, and not just from his mother, but from his father as well. It was a complete severing of the family relationship in that sense. And you notice how, as our chairman read today from his particular translation in verse 11, how that the two sentences are in the verse are intended to convey that idea. This is how Rodahims translates it. Then Elkanah went to Ramah unto his own house. Pause. But the boy remained ministering unto Yahweh. There's been a separation now. That separation is complete, both between mother and father, and the child did minister unto Yahweh. Now, you see that word minister? It's used in some political and domestic contexts, but by far the most frequent usage for that term is for the priests in service at the sanctuary. Exodus 28, verse 35 and verse 43 would be typical examples. The word minister here is used of the priests in their service at the sanctuary. And I think that's what we're being told, you see, is that to whatever degree his age permitted, from the very earliest moments, Samuel began to learn the priestly role and the priestly law. In fact, one of the things he would learn very early on was he would start on his instruction in the things of the Torah. And he would first learn to read the Torah, and then he would learn to recite the Torah, and finally he would be able to teach the Torah. All of this would start in the life of the little boy, as he was in Shiloh, ministering with the priests, and in a sense, beginning already to minister as a priest. Of course, it says he did it before Eli the priest. He might have done it all under Eli's watchful eye, because clearly Eli would have acted in setting and approving the tasks that the child could perform. And yet notice that even now, although he's under Eli's responsibility, that it says that the child ministered unto Yahweh. It's almost as if from the first moment this little boy had grasped his calling to priestly office. He was a little priest in the making, even now. And just as well that he was, because the sons of Eli, of course, who were called to a life of holiness in priestly service, had never attained to the honour of thinking or behaving that way, as the record will now go on to tell us. And so in verse 12, now the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, they knew not Yahweh. Do you know the word Eli comes from the Hebrew word Allah, which means to ascend. It's the root word for the burnt offering, to ascend, the ascending offering. But the word Belial comes from two Hebrew words, Beli, which means not or without, and the word Ya'al, which means prophet. And so the real translation, the real significance of Belial, effectively, is worthlessness. It's absolutely without profit. Worthlessness. So Hophni and Phinehas, far from being the sons of ascension, which they should have been, were actually sons of worthlessness. They had never ascended into the heavenly places of spiritual thought and worship where Hannah walked in her mind. These were base men. They were corrupt men. And the ultimate statement of verse 12 is, they knew not Yahweh, which incidentally is the high point of the truth, the place that we all desire to come to, the place we all desire to arrive at. That in the journey of our spiritual life to the kingdom, that we come to know Yahweh. This woman did. These priests didn't. No wonder there was a controversy between the two. And we're going to look at why that is from verse 13 onwards. But before we do that, I'm going to take you back to the book of the law and just to look at this matter of the peace offering in slightly more detail, because you'll find it's extremely helpful in understanding what's actually taking place in the matters of the 1st of Samuel chapter 2. So if you come back to Leviticus and to the 7th chapter, we referred to this in the matter of that offering of thanksgiving, remember? But let me draw your attention to one or two other details that the law provided for with regard to peace offerings in particular, that we might understand how terrible the sins of Hophni and Phinehas were. Now, this is what it says in Leviticus chapter 7. Actually, we might start with Leviticus chapter 3. If you come back to Leviticus 3, which is the other main chapter about peace offerings, notice what it says in Leviticus chapter 3, verse 1. It says, if his oblation be a sacrifice of peace offering, if he offer it of the herd, whether it be male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before Yahweh, and he shall lay his hand upon the head of the offering and kill it at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle the blood upon the altar round about. Do you know that this is an interesting thing? Because it's the only offering where the offerer offered it himself. He's involved, she's involved, they're involved in this matter of offering. Now, as soon as the peace offering was offered, notice what the law said, verse 3. There's a bit that goes to God first. Verse 3, he shall offer of the sacrifice of the peace offering, an offering made by fire unto Yahweh, the fat that covers the inwards, and all the fat that is upon the inwards, and the two kidneys, and the fat that is on them, that is by the flanks, and the caul above the liver with the kidneys, he shall take it away. Because that bit was the piece that belonged to God. And to God that went first, you see, in the order of the peace offering. First of all, God must receive his part. And what part does God want? God wants the fat. Now, the word fat here is the word cheleb in the Hebrew, C-H-E-L-E-B. And actually, the word means the best part, the choicest part, the finest part. It's translated in Numbers 18, verse 12, as the best of the oil and the best of the wine, cheleb. It's translated in Psalm 147, verse 14, as the finest of the wheat, cheleb. So when it says that God wanted the fat, what it really means is he considered that part, that inward part, to be the very finest, the inward, the deepest, innermost thoughts of the person. That's the bit that God wants. Who we really are, deep down inside, that's Yahweh's choicest part. That comes to me first, says God. And if you come back to chapter 7 now, notice what the law goes on to say about the rest of the animal and what was to happen. So the fat to God first. And in Leviticus 7, in the record there, it says in verse 29, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, and notice the involvement of the offerer here, he that offereth the sacrifice of his peace offerings unto Yahweh shall bring his oblation unto Yahweh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hands shall bring the offering of Yahweh made by fire. The fat with the breast it shall he bring, that the breast may be waved for a wave offering before Yahweh. And the priest shall burn the fat upon the altar, but the breast shall be Aaron's and his sons. And the right shoulder ye shall give unto the priest for an heave offering of the sacrifices of your peace offering. Now, let's just stop for a moment and decipher what's being told to us here. So remember, first, the fat. The fat comes to God. That's the choicest part from God's perspective. But notice that the right shoulder, verse 32, which is known as the heave shoulder, was to be given to the officiating priest. Now, of course, you probably know that in the Authorized Version, the right shoulder is probably not an accurate translation. It really means the hind leg or the right thigh, because it's an animal. It's the hind leg, the right thigh of the animal. And the priest was given that. Do you know why? Because when the priest ate that portion, it symbolized the divine acceptance of the offering, because the priest represented God. So when he ate that portion, he was signifying, on behalf of God, the acceptance of that sacrifice. And what was the piece that went to him? It was the best cut of meat, the strongest part of the animal, representing the place of the greatest strength. The surrender of one's own strength is part of what the offerer was surrendering up to God in this process. I give to God my greatest strength. So to the priest went that right shoulder, or the right thigh, symbolic of that which the offerer desired to do. But not just the right shoulder. We're told in verse 30 that the breast, the wave breast, belonged to Aaron and his sons. Now, what we've got here in the breast is the consecration of the heart of a person in symbol. And so the person bringing this offering acknowledges that they could not approach God without the presence of a priest to mediate on their behalf. And so the very consecration of the priests themselves, by the way, in the book of the law, in Numbers chapter 8, was consecrated by means of a wave offering. Well, now this breast is given to Aaron and his sons as high priest, that they might wave it in consecration. And you notice what it was also associated with, because in this chapter, a little further back, in verses 11 to 13, we're told of the other things that would accompany the offering, and that was, verse 12, unleavened cakes mingled with oil, unleavened wafers mingled with oil, cakes mingled with oil of fine flour fried, and beside the cakes he shall offer for his offering leavened bread with the sacrifice of thanksgiving of his peace offering. Now that's astonishing. That never happened at any other time in the schedule of offerings. Unleavened bread, yes, but leavened bread? You never offered leavened bread upon God's altar, surely not. What was this leavened bread for? And I think the answer is that what the leavened bread did is it reminded the offerer that even though he was permitted to take the rest of the animal, the fat's gone, the right shoulder's gone, the wave breast is gone, the rest of the animal is yours, you may eat it now in fellowship with God, but lest you might mistake the matter, you ought to understand that you are never in a position to eat in fellowship with God based on your supposed own perfection. Even now, you can only eat because of God's grace, because of God's mercy, not because of your righteousness. You eat it with leavened bread. So I think that the unleavened cakes set forth the ideal that true fellowship with God finally will only be experienced when sin is removed from our lives. But what the leavened bread did is proclaim the reality of the present, that in our lives now we are permitted to fellowship with God, but only on the basis of his merciful forgiveness of our present sinful state. It is only in God's mercy that we have that privilege of fellowship granted to us. So this is an unusual story, really, the story of the peace offering, because this animal, as it were, was apportioned out in these different ways. The fat, the shoulder, the breast, and now to the offerer comes the rest of the offering, that they might sit down and have that fellowship meal and to have it, as it were, with God. You can imagine, it must have been a wonderful moment, that of all the whole schedule of the offerings in the law of Moses, to come now with this peace offering was the climax, you see. Well, that takes us back to the 1 Samuel chapter 2. Now, let's just see how evil these two priests were, Hophni and Phinehas, in their behaviour. Because when it says in verse 12, the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, sons of worthlessness, they knew not Yahweh. Verse 13 is going to go on to explain why it was that they were such evil men. So it says in verse 13, the priest's custom with the people was, that's in these days, in the days of Hophni and Phinehas, because it wasn't the normal custom. You know that word custom, it's the Hebrew word mishpat, which means the law of God. And all through the Torah, they were instructed to keep the mishpat of God, the mishpat of God, the mishpat of God. But you see, what Hophni and Phinehas have done here is they decided to establish their own mishpat. They've got their own law in violation of God's principles. It was the custom of the priests, not God's. And their custom was, verse 13, that when any man offered sacrifice, see that word sacrifice? That's the word zebak. That's the word that relates to the peace offering. It refers to the offerer's portion, something that only happened with the peace offering. So clearly we're being told that this is a peace offering. When the man came to offer the peace offering, and he's dealing now, that man is dealing with the peace that's left back to him, his portion of the peace offering. Well, says the record, it says that the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand. Now, let me just set the scene for you. So the offerer has arrived. They've offered, firstly, a sin offering. So they've confessed sin. They've offered a burnt offering, they've vowed dedication. And now they're ready to participate in the joy of fellowship with their God. They're about to consume the peace offering. The fellowship meal is being prepared. The fat has gone to God to be burnt upon the altar straight away. The officiating priest has received the right thigh. The sons of Aaron have been given the wave breast. The offerer's portion is cooking right now. All the other arrangements for the meal are being organized. They're just about to sit down and eat with God. And that's the moment when these priest servants arrived. And they arrived, it says, with a flesh hook of three teeth. And the purpose of that flesh hook, verse 14, was he struck it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and all that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took for himself. You see that word flesh hook? It's the word used in the book of the law in Exodus 27 verse 3 and Exodus 38 verse 3 for the flesh hooks that were used at the altar of burnt offering. So they were part of the furniture of the tabernacle. And what they were for, incidentally, was to move the sacrificial pieces on God's altar. And they're considered to be part of the holy things of the tabernacle, says Numbers 4 verse 14. They're holy things, those flesh hooks. They're to move the actual sacrificial parts on God's altar. And what these men did, Hophni and Phinehas, they took God's instruments from his altar and they used them for their own ends. You see, they'd already received the very best part of the animal, the right thigh, as officiating priest, but they wanted more. They wanted the best part of what was not theirs. And I want you to notice something interesting about verses 13 and 14. Do you see where the focus is? Now, look carefully. The focus in these two verses is all on the idea of aggressive deeds. Verse 13, the priest's servant came with a flesh hook. Verse 14, he struck it into the pan. All that the flesh hook brought up, the priest took, and so they did. They're all words of action, and they're all aggressive actions. Here is the spirit of Hophni, the man of the clenched fist, who's known for aggressive deeds. And what they did is they challenged the portions of the offering, and they interfered with the cooking of the meal of the sacrifice. And they did it at the worst possible moment as far as the offerer was concerned. And what they did is they destroyed the people's fellowship meal with Yahweh. They came between the saints and their God. At the very moment that those people were to sit down to eat the meal with their God, that meal was interrupted. They destroyed the people's fellowship meal with their God. And if that wasn't bad enough, verse 15 says they did something else even worse. Because verse 15 says, also, before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest. Now, do you notice that both of these episodes are marked out very carefully in terms of their timing? Where does the confrontation of verse 13 occur? While the flesh was in seething. Do you know what that refers to in verse 13? As we've said, it refers to the moment of the offerer's portion being prepared for eating. But what's the time of this confrontation in verse 15? It's before they burnt the fat. What does that relate to? That's not the offerer's portion. This is Yahweh's portion. This is the part that belongs to God. The fat that's taken first and placed upon God's altar. And at that moment, they said, they came, and they said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest. And verse 16 says, if any man said unto them, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as thy soul desireth. So you see, offering the fat to God immediately after the slaying of the animal was the absolute priority that the law of Moses laid down. This peace offering is going to end up with you being able to partake of it, but not before God first has received his portion. So Rotherhams translates that as follows, that the response of the person offering was to say, Rotherhams, let them at least make incense at once with fat and then take. Or as the Revised Standard Version says, surely burn the fat first and then take. The offerers were horrified at the thought that God's fat would be taken and that this would be interrupted before even that happened. And so notice what it says. They said, well, take the fat first, burn that first. Don't stop to burn that first. The law says that's got to happen first. And then you can have as much as you like, as much as thy soul desireth. You see, here's the conciliatory spirit of offerers who were actually prepared to give up much of their own portion of the meal as long as God was honoured with his rightful portion. That was a good spirit on the part of these offerers. At least give God his portion. If you want some of mine, that's okay. You can take as much as you like of my part. But do not take that which belongs to God. And yet that gentle answer was met with a vulgar, brute demand. And the man said, nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force. And that word now that's used there is clearly used over against the word presently earlier in the verse. Don't fail to burn the fat presently. And he says, no, I want it now. And so the implication was that burning the fat unto Yahweh doesn't come first. Giving me the portion I want comes first. That's the spirit of Hophni and Phinehas. And if the truth be known, they probably took even the fat that belonged to Yahweh to make their roasts even more delicious. That's what they had done. Now, do you notice what the focus is of verses 15 and 16? It's, surprisingly, on arrogant words. Read them carefully. Verse 15. And also before they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man, "Give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee, but raw." Verse 16. "And if any man said unto him, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as thy soul desireth, then he would answer him and said, nay, but thou shalt give it me now, and if not, I will take it by force." They're all about arrogant words. Here's the spirit of Phinehas, the man of the brazen mouth. Well, isn't that interesting? So the two examples that are brought forth here in the context of firstly verses 13 and 14 is the spirit of aggressive deeds, and verses 15 and 16, the spirit of arrogant words. That's Hophni and Phinehas, right here in the record. And you know what they do in verse 16? They challenge the order of the offering, and by interrupting the burning of the fat on the altar, what they really did is they destroyed Yahweh's fellowship meal with his people. They did it both ways. They destroyed the people's meal with God, and they destroyed God's meal with the people. That's what these two men did. Wherefore, as verse 17 says, "Wherefore, the sin of the young men was very great before Yahweh." You see, it wasn't just the evil of their bad example and their greed and their aggressive deeds and their arrogant words. All of that was hateful and horrible. But their real sin lay in a contempt for divine principles which permitted and encouraged and legitimized a similar spirit of ungodliness amongst the people. And so Green's literal translation says, "Men despised the offering." Or Rotherham says, "Men scorned the offering." And you can imagine that's probably what they did do, because what's the use? What's the point? We come to worship God and to draw near to him, and these brutish priests arrive to smash it all up. And worst of all, the climax of the peace offering centered on the wonder of worshipping a God who desired to share a fellowship meal with his people. And at that sacred, special, precious moment, these scoundrels came and destroyed it all. Now do we understand why Hannah couldn't eat when she went to the sanctuary year by year? Now do we understand why she couldn't properly partake of the fellowship meal with her God? Now do we understand why Hannah's real adversaries were not Penina or the Philistines, but these two men and all that they stood for? Now do we understand why she prayed for a son and vowed him to God to be his instrument in restoring fellowship to himself? She hated the spirit, and she hated it on God's behalf, because now people came and couldn't care less about the worship of God anyway, because of the influence of these two boys, these two priests, the sons of Eli, who were nothing other than sons of Belial. And so verse 18 says, "But Samuel ministered before Yahweh, being a child." It's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got a clear contrast, haven't you, between verse 17 and verse 18. Hophni and Phinehas sinned before Yahweh. Verse 18, Samuel ministered before Yahweh. And whereas Hophni and Phinehas did what they did against the face and in defiance of God, Samuel did what he did before the face and in the honour of God. And so the but here indicates that his spirit and his work was in such complete contrast to these two. This little boy was everything that Hophni and Phinehas was not. Now, where did that spirit of ministering so passionately before God, where did that spirit come from in this little boy? Why, from the woman whose child he was. This lent one, loaned unto Yahweh in Shiloh, left there, was quintessentially Hannah's child through and through. And so the spirit of this woman, so deeply imbued with a love of things divine, glowed in the heart and shone on the face of this child who gladdened the spirit of all that saw him. When people came to the sanctuary now and they saw this earnest, serious, godly little boy going about his tasks, hope stirred in the heart because he was such a contrast. And who was he? He was a child. There's almost a sense of wonder about that. You notice how that's repeated, by the way. So verse 11, the child did minister unto Yahweh before Eli the priest. Here verse 18, the child ministered. Chapter 3 verse 1, and the child Samuel ministered unto Yahweh before Eli. There's almost a sense of wonder here. As Rotherham says, as for Samuel, he was ministering before Yahweh, a boy, girded with an ephod of linen. But you see, he wasn't any boy. He was Hannah's child. And therein lay the secret of his role. So verse 18 says that not only did he minister, and not only did he minister before the Lord, and not only did he minister being a child before the Lord, but he ministered girded with a linen ephod. At some point, you see, Samuel absorbed his mother's spirit, and his own life of Nazarite dedication is going to embrace Hannah's vow and make it his own. From the very beginning, he's marked out for priesthood. But he's going to be a priest based on a higher order than that of Aaron. Now, it's interesting because, you see, it says he wore a linen ephod. Now, that ephod is a distinctly priestly garment. In fact, in this very chapter, just come over the page to verse 28. In the judgment upon Eli, it says this. Did I not choose him, that's Aaron, my father, out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest? What does a priest do? To offer upon mine altar, to burn incense, and to wear an ephod before me. Ah, that's who wears an ephod. Priests wear ephods. It's a priestly article of clothing. In fact, it's the symbol of divine communication. Now, what's interesting is that someone put that little linen ephod on that little boy. Someone must have understood the destiny of this child. And I'm not sure whether it was Hannah. But we'll come back to that, shall we? We'll ponder that for a moment. But the important thing to note is that someone understood the future of this child and placed upon him, I think, a prophecy of his own destiny. And it was his own destiny because, now see what the record goes on to say. So it says in verse 19, moreover, that means in addition to what's just come before, the child girded with a linen ephod, moreover, his mother made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Now, isn't it interesting? We've got the child, verse 18, and the mother, verse 19, in close juxtaposition in these two verses. So what we've got is an Old Testament story of what? A mother and the child. And that's going to come into the gospel record, isn't it? A mother and a child will be the story of Mary and Jesus in the gospel story. It begins here in the story of Hannah and Samuel. And I think that Hannah's influence upon Samuel was absolutely profound. So I think Hannah had thought all this through. As you can imagine, Hannah would do. She always thought everything through, didn't she? That's who Hannah was. She didn't leave anything to chance in this story. And she knew that her contact with him was going to be very limited. The annual pilgrimage of the family would be her one moment to connect with Samuel each year. And in that one moment of visiting Shiloh, she needed to refocus his direction and set the scene for his next 12 months, his next year, the next year of his life. And when she arrived for that moment at the sanctuary, all her love and all her care and all her purpose would be poured into that visit. So the question is, what could she do to maximize her influence upon her son for good on the occasion of that visit? And she thought about it all that first year back in Ramah. She decided what she would do. So when she came up the next time, it says she brought him a little coat. Do you know, that one single action was so full of meaning that it fired up that little boy's heart for life. He never ever forgot what his mother did. It inspired him for the rest of his life. That moment when the mother brought up a little coat. Oh, she knew what to do. She knew exactly what to do. And notice that, by the way, the record says that she did it. You see that there? Read carefully, verse 19. Moreover, his mother brought him a little coat. This is not his father. His mother brought the little coat. And when all the yearly feast days were ended, there would be many... Well, what happened, of course, in the feast? You know what happened. There was a feast at the time of Passover, wasn't there? Which was sort of springtime. And then there was a feast a little bit later on, if they did go to one later on, as they came through the harvest season of wheat harvest. And then there was another feast at the Feast of Tabernacles, by which time all the summer fruit had been gathered in. And beyond that season, when the feasts of the year were ended, there would be all the long, hard, cold months before spring returned. But I don't think that she brought the little coat to keep him warm. Because if that was her plan, she would have left the little coat with him. But she didn't. She took it home with her. We know that because that's what the record says. See verse 19? Moreover, his mother made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. You see, in the Hebrew, the phrase from year to year doesn't govern the action of making the coat. It governs the action of bringing the coat. Now, it may well be that as Samuel grew, she might have adjusted the size. But the thing that happened from year to year is that she brought the coat up with her. So Young's literal translation says, and a small upper coat doth his mother make to him, and she hath brought it up to him from time to time in her coming up with her husband to sacrifice, the sacrifice of the time. So this was not a succession of little coats, but a succession of occasions the little coat was brought up for Samuel to wear. And incidentally, it was always at the same time. It was always at the yearly sacrifice. So here's the question. Why did she do that? Why didn't she give him the coat and leave it there? What was the point of taking it up in the first place if all she was going to do was take it back home again? Well, that's an interesting question, isn't it? No, I think we can do it now. So now picture the scene. 1 year later, first time she's coming up. Can you imagine little Samuel coming running out of the tabernacle because mum's arrived? Emma, Emma! And Hannah says, Shalom, Haben Sheli. Peace, my son. I've brought you a present. This is a special robe that reminds me that you're a priest now. And I hope it will help remind you too. This will be your special gift to wear while we're together, you and I, at the sanctuary. It's like the robe the high priest wears. And indeed it was. because on every occasion that this word for the little coat is used before this story in Hannah, it refers exclusively to the robe of the ephod worn by the high priest. On every occasion before this moment, here's the references. Exodus 28, verse 4, verse 31, verse 34. Exodus 29, verse 5. Exodus 39, verses 22 to 26. In every one of those verses, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26. And Leviticus 8, verse 7. Now, we shan't turn all of those up, but let's just turn one up because it's helpful. In Exodus chapter 29 and verse 5, let's just use this one as an illustration. But this is the same word, you see, translated the little coat. This is what it really means. It's how it's translated in the law. So we're told in Exodus 29 and verse 5, it says, thou shalt take the garments and put upon Aaron the coat and the robe of the ephod. Ah, that's the word translated little coat in the first of Samuel. The robe of the ephod. And notice also, in addition to the robe of the ephod, that the priest also wore the ephod itself. So there was an ephod and there was a robe of an ephod. There were two different things. Now you see, the robe of the ephod divided two sets of clothing that the high priest wore. Underneath the robe of the ephod were the linen garments that he wore together with all his sons. But outside the robe of the ephod were the garments for glory and beauty that were worn exclusively by the high priest. And so the robe of the ephod marks the change where the garments altered from just an ordinary priest to become a high priest. The robe of the ephod is where the story of the garments changes. And that robe, we're told, had a special collar woven so strong that it could not be torn. It symbolized the high priest would unite the nation unto himself through his anointing. Now, what's interesting is that these two articles of the high priest's clothing, the robe of the ephod and the ephod itself, so they're both mentioned there in that quotation in Exodus 29, verse 5. Those two articles of the high priest's clothing are found together in a remarkable episode in David's life. It's in the First of Chronicles chapter 15. Just come and have a look at it, because these two articles were worn by David on one particular occasion, but only on one occasion that we know of. And it was clearly a very significant moment in David's life. It's the day when he brought the Ark of God up to Zion. And on that day, we're told that something rather unusual happened. It says in verse 26 of the First of Chronicles 15, came to pass, when God helped the Levites that bear the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh, that they offered seven bullocks and seven rams. And David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, and all the Levites that bear the Ark, and the singers, and Kenaniah, the master of the song with the singers. David also had upon him an ephod of linen. So David had two different articles of clothing on: a robe of fine linen and an ephod of linen. And what he was doing on this day, in his joy of bringing the Ark of God to Zion, and I think under the power of the Holy Spirit, he was setting forth within himself a prophecy of Christ's future work. That there would be a Messiah king, Messiah Melech, and a Messiah priest, Messiah Kohen. And he's in Salem, the city of Melchizedek, the man who was both king of righteousness and priest of the Most High God. And the record tells us that only David wore those two garments. And that robe of the fine linen is the same as the robe of the ephod of the book of the law. And he also had upon him an ephod of linen that relates to the ephod that the high priest wore. Now here's the prophecy that I think David was setting forth on this day as he danced before the ark. He was saying that he who, as representative of his people, was the king of righteousness, the robe of fine linen, would also have the right to enter into the presence of God for divine communication as his priest, the ephod of linen. Shall I say that again? That he who is representative of his people was the king of righteousness, the robe of fine linen, would also have the right to enter into the presence of God for divine communication as his priest, the ephod of linen. Only one man had ever held those rites together in unity, and his name was Melchizedek. He was both king and priest. And do you know what Melchizedek did? We're told, aren't we, in Genesis chapter 14, verse 18. You don't need to turn it up because you'll know what the record says. It says that Melchizedek brought something forth. What did he bring forth? He brought forth bread and wine. Do you remember that? Now come over the page and see what David does on this occasion. He dances before the ark. He's got those two robes, the robe of the ephod and the ephod that the high priest wore. And in the First Chronicles 16, when it's all over, verse 2, when David had made an end of offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of Yahweh. By the way, who blessed the people in God's name? Answer, the priest. It's a priestly blessing that David gives. And verse 3 says, he dealt to every one of Israel, both man and woman, a loaf of bread and a good piece of flesh and a flagon of wine. David brought forth bread and wine. He was enacting a prophecy of the Melchizedek order on this particular day. In fact, I believe that this moment, this very moment in time, was the basis for when, in the Spirit of God, Psalm 110 was given to David. The Lord said unto my Lord, Yahweh said unto my Adon, sit thou at thy right hand, my right hand, until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. It was an amazing day in David's life when he wore those two garments. Now here's the thing. Outside of the robes of the high priest and the book of the law, and this occasion in the First of Chronicles, chapter 15, there's only one other place in the whole of Scripture where those two articles of clothing are found together. And it's here in the story of Hannah and her little boy. So coming back to the 1st of Samuel chapter 2, when it says in verse 18, he had a linen ephod, verse 19 in effect says, and he also wore the robe of an ephod. And Hannah did that deliberately. And I think her action in clothing him with that robe was extraordinary. Because what she was saying, she was absolutely repudiating the priesthood of Hophni and Phinehas. She would have nothing to do with their priestly work. She would have no part of their priestly intercession. And I think she declared by placing that little robe of the ephod on Samuel when she came up, that this boy is my priestly representative. Oh yes, he might only be a boy. He might only be a priest in principle. But I recognize him as God's channel of divine communication and not the priesthood of Eli or his sons Hophni and Phinehas. It was her declaration that she repudiated the priesthood of Hophni and Phinehas and cast all her hope upon a priest to come in the form of her little boy who's clothed with those robes. Only other place in Scripture where those two places, those two articles of clothing are to be found. And now also we understand, I think, why she brought the robe up only once a year. Because the high priest didn't wear those robes every day. He only wore them on special occasions when he was fulfilling his priestly office. He didn't wear the robe of the ephod and the garments for glory and beauty on anything other than those moments when he was executing his tasks as the high priest of the nation. David didn't wear his robe of the ephod and his linen ephod all the time, only on that special occasion when he danced before Yahweh with all his might. You see, Hannah wasn't claiming Samuel to be the priestly representative for all the nation, at least not at this stage, but he could be her priest in prospect. And she claimed that right only in the context of her appearance at the sanctuary once a year. At that moment, at that time, she rejected Hophni and Phinehas, even though she submitted to their ungodly behaviour, but she declared her belief that in this child lay the seed of a new and better priesthood. And that's the only time he needed to wear the little robe. When his mother was there, and they were worshipping God together. And I think that what Hannah did is she came up with that little robe. Every year she brought the robe up. Here's the robe, my son. Now put it on. Now let us go into the house of God together. Can you just imagine this woman dealing with this? Do you think that Samuel was affected by that? Let me show you something interesting. 1 Samuel chapter 15. I don't think he ever forgot. I think he was hugely affected by the story of the little coat. 1 Samuel 15, verse 27. And as Samuel turned about to go away, Saul laid hold upon the skirt of his mantle and it rent. Whose mantle? Samuel's mantle. Samuel wore a mantle. Come to chapter 28, the story of the witch of Endor, 1 Samuel 28. Remember the story of the witch of Endor? Now, by the way, she didn't really see Samuel coming up. She pretended to. But notice how she describes him. The king said, 1 Samuel 28, verse 13, the king said unto her, be not afraid, what sawest thou? And the woman said unto Saul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. And he said unto her, what form is he of? And she said, an old man cometh up, and he is covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel. Do you know why he perceived that? Because Samuel always wore that mantle. And that word for mantle is the same word for the little coat his mother brought in the 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 19. She placed that robe upon him as a little boy, and it set the direction of his entire life. He accepted the burden of responsibility that that little coat put upon his shoulders, and in spirit, he never, ever put it off. He wore that mantle for the rest of his life. It became the mark of his special priesthood. And how did all that begin? When his mother arrived every year with a peace offering for God, a priestly mantle for her son, and the fellowship tokens of bread and wine that the family might share them together. What an amazing thing. And all this happened, says verse 19 of the 1 Samuel chapter 2. She brought it to him from year to year, when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. So there it is, you see. When we think about the breadth of what this woman envisaged and how this woman thought, we can only be astonished and humbled. If she knew all that, then she must have known that her child was a figure of one to come. She knew that Samuel wasn't Messiah, but she saw Messiah in prospect in her son. She saw the Melchizedek order in her son. She saw a new order of priesthood being made possible in this little boy. And if that's true, what else did she know about the meaning of Messiah's future work? What else did she see reaching forward into the mysteries of Melchizedek that others hadn't seen? What was her vision? What did she really hope for out of all of this? Well, that, indeed, is the subject of our next study. So shall we close with a hymn? Hymn 268. A hymn that certainly captures the spirit of Hannah at this time. And reading from the first verse, the vision tarrieth not, at the appointed time it speaks by man for God's purposes sublime. Yea, though it tarry long and seemeth not to grow, let faith and hope be strong. The word of God ye know. Hymn 268. The workshop is at 2:30. You now have free time.
Thank you. turn this thing off.